Hello, this is Chris with the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, April 3rd. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. Longest running president moving on, from Savoy. In 1986, Bob McCleary walked into a conversation his wife Dee Dee and her friend Becky Pittman were having about the future of the Savoy Village Administration. A group was planning to run as a block for mayor, and the village's three trustee seats, a move a portion of the residents in town were against. As McCleary entered the room, Pittman said, "Why isn't Bob running?" To which Dee Dee McCleary responded, "He could run. That would be good." She told him to go get a petition, fill it out, and turn it in. "I didn't argue," she said. "Bob should run," so Bob ran. McCleary, 63, would spend 2 years as a village trustee before running for village president. He won that election, too, and six more after that. When ballots are cast Tuesday, Savoy residents will choose between John Brown and Joan Dykstra to be the new village president. McCleary, the longest-serving president in Savoy's history, is stepping down after 28 years in the role. McCleary and his wife purchased property in a house near the Shawnee National Forest in southern Illinois and will be relocating there after he opens the May 3rd Village Board meeting as its president for the final time. "We're moving, and that's why I brought an end to it here," he said. "We hope to put our house on the market a couple of days after that, and we'll see how long it takes to sell the house here. We'll get through that process and move on." McCleary never thought he'd serve as long as he has, either as a trustee or a president, but there was always something on the agenda that kept him coming back. "Every time I got to the end of a 4-year term, there was something that made me go, 'Darn it, I just want to get that finished.'" Plenty has been accomplished in the village since McCleary took over. The population has grown from 2,126 to about 8,600 today. In 1987, when McCleary became a trustee, Savoy had few businesses: Best Western, Prairie Land Feed, Skateland, and Old Orchard Lanes. The village brought in approximately $38,000 in sales tax the year before McCleary became president. Last year, Savoy brought in about $2.5 million in sales tax. "If you can bring in money like that, you don't have to raise people's property taxes. We keep it as low as we can every year. I only asked for property taxes to be raised one time, and that was to start a police fund because we had no tax for police in our property tax, and that was passed. We started collecting money so we could pay a contract with the county. It's been a savior. It made sense to me and the board." Savoy landed an elementary school, Kerry Busey, and the fire station, municipal building, and public works department were centralized in the city to make life simpler for residents. "Being able to build a core of the community where people can go to one area and see the people they need to is a huge thing for a community." McCleary, though, heaps a great deal of praise for the growth and development of the village onto the behind-the-scenes types, the village board members and administrators who believed in the vision for the community and all worked in concert to make it happen. "What I'm proudest of is the board. What they do for this community, they have bought into our comprehensive plan, they do the things they need to, and when we need to increase staff, they listen. It's the evolution of how we got here that I'm proudest of. People bought into what I was trying to sell us, the way we're going to get to this end of this comprehensive plan. It was something in the plan that was the driver for me staying." Savoy Village manager Dick Helton said McCleary helped grow the community by doing things the right way. "He could be given a lot of credit, but he doesn't take a lot of credit. He's a very humble person who's led this community to what it is." In 2005, a couple of years before the economy crashed, McCleary and the board passed an initiative to decrease the size of lots being sold for new homes. There was no reason that you'd put something like that in place. Everyone was buying big lots and building these $350,000 and $400,000 houses. Then the economy went to the tank, and one of the few places in Champaign County where people were building was in our subdivisions, where we had the ability to make small lots, and you could put a house there for less than $200,000 into the ground, and we built houses. In the late 1990s, McCleary talked the board into paying for $18,000 worth of sewer engineering work near the site where Walmart currently sits in the event of future development there. That move ended up saving the city about $70,000 for the same work years later. It's the thinking ahead that's fantastic to me. That has been the fun for me, thinking ahead and working it out. Said Helton, he set the stage, and that's going to be a tough one to follow. The mayor should be able to set the tone for the community, and he's done that. Also on the front page, hurt as bad or worse than Madoff's victims, from Urbana. A Rantoul man who stole thousands of dollars from people who trusted him to help them in real estate transactions is headed to prison for 4 years. Brandon Jackson, 30, also must repay 7 victims a total of $113,000. Judge Roger Weber didn't buy Assistant Public Defender Tony Allegretti's argument that his client was hardly the Bernie Madoff of Champaign County. During Friday's sentencing, Weber said the only difference between Madoff, the notorious Wall Street investor convicted of swindling billions from wealthy clients, and Jackson, who had a single prior conviction for theft, was the amount of money taken from the victims. In terms of the percentage of individual wealth, these people might have been hurt as bad or worse than Madoff's victims. The imprisonment and restitution come on top of a judgment totaling $51,000 that Jackson was ordered to pay in February in a civil suit filed by one of his crime victims. Assistant Attorney General Sandra Talbot sought a 6-year prison sentence for Jackson, who pleaded guilty in February to participating in a continuing financial crimes enterprise. Allegretti asked the judge to consider probation for Jackson. The single count to which he pleaded guilty alleged that between September 30th and October 26, 2016, Jackson forged 4 different checks for a total of $26,400 that was withdrawn from 2 accounts at Busey Bank. In exchange for his plea, 6 other accounts of forgery, theft, identity theft, and participating in a continuing financial crimes enterprise were dismissed against Jackson, who last lived in the 1500 block of South Point Drive. The criminal acts alleged in all the counts happened between December 2014 and October 2016. Jackson was arrested in mid-November, a day after the criminal charges were filed. He pleaded guilty February 22nd. To aggravate Jackson's sentence, Talbot had some of the victims in the charges that were dismissed tell Weber what they had gone through with deals with Jackson. Amber Stowe said she and her husband were trying to buy a house in Paxton and were referred to Jackson, a mortgage loan originator, for Movement Mortgage. He told them he could help them obtain a mortgage despite their poor credit rating. Stowe testified Jackson told him he needed money for various services aimed at repairing their credit score and expunging a bankruptcy. The couple wrote checks made out to Jackson for those services, as well as for appraisals that Jackson told them they needed to refinance their existing home and on the home they were hoping to buy. At Jackson's direction, they even put a $13,000 down payment on the home. Stowe said he told them on 5 different occasions that a closing had been scheduled when none ever had been. In October 2016, as they waited for a closing date, Stowe testified she was balancing her checking account when she discovered 2 checks for $3,000 each made out to Jackson, which she had not authorized. Confronting him about those, Jackson called it a mistake and agreed to repay the couple, but his check bounced. Champaign Police Detective Pat Kelly, who specializes in financial crimes, also testified about a case he investigated in late September. It involved an 88-year-old Champaign man whose name appeared on what turned out to be 2 counterfeit checks totaling more than $20,000, which Midland State Bank agreed to cash based on Jackson's representation that he was involved in a real estate transaction with the account holder, which he was not. The account holder's bank declined to honor the checks, so he was not out anything. Kelly said at the time of Jackson's arrest, he found other counterfeit checks in his car and a check for $19,000 payable to Jackson from an account holder who told Kelly his account had been compromised. Also in the car, Kelly said, were loan documents from the Stowes and another woman who said she was trying to obtain a mortgage from Jackson and had given him $1,500 to get the process started. Jackson apologized to his victims, telling them he was sorry for the bad decisions and mistakes he had made. He acknowledged he would never be able to work in the loan business or banking again, but said he wanted to pay them back and had to be free to work to do that. Also from Urbana, Navy man not fazed by D-Day roll. Recalls shells dropping around during landing craft's run to Normandy. A D-Day veteran calls his own service in World War II small potatoes. Fresh out of geological engineering school, Ralph Langenheim was sped through Navy training, became a lieutenant junior grade, didn't get his choice of sub-chasing, and was instead placed into the amphibious force not long before the most amphibious landing in world history. Langenheim, 94, longtime University of Illinois professor and former Champaign County board member, remembers the hours before dawn on June 6, 1944, as quiet, subdued, and filled with foreboding. He was a landlubber from Tulsa and studied petroleum geology in college. The Navy rushed him through training, including time at Annapolis Naval Academy. Langenheim's landing craft left for England in February 1944. His trip traveled around Gibraltar, the Azores, England, and France. He later shipped to Kodiak Island in Alaska to prepare for an invasion of Asia. Most vividly, just before dawn on that June 6th, the lieutenant was on a landing craft dieseling toward German-held France. USS Landing Craft Infantry 551 had left England out of Dartmouth the night before after a day's delay because of bad weather. After midnight, there were some flashes of light. He heard planes that he assumes were carrying paratroopers. More flashes followed, then explosions. Just before sunrise, Langenheim not only heard artillery fire, but could smell it. About 6:30 a.m., LCI 551 altered course toward the beach. That was when, Langenheim recalls, a corpse floated by, not far from the wreckage of the U.S. destroyer sunk by the Germans. For the next few hours, his landing craft maneuvered offshore. About 4 p.m., Langenheim's landing craft was ordered to hit the beach, Utah Beach, the first of the two American landing zones. Shells kept plopping into the water more or less at random during our entire stay on the beach. A northward current kept pushing the landing craft off course during the landings, so the crew used anchor cable to correct for it while under fire. We'd rev up the engine and try to keep in place with shells dropping nearby. We didn't get hit, he says, shrugging. None of his shipmates were hurt in the entire ordeal, but the infantry troops fell into craters created by shell landings and went turtle up. Some of our troops drowned. You wouldn't believe how much equipment they had to carry. The ship spent 3 days off Utah Beach. 5 days later, he wrote a letter home that blandly omits any mention of D-Day. Dear folks, as usual, there is little to be said that can pass through the censorship. This is very definitely a pain in the neck. Shipboard life is much the same. Nothing very big has gone out of commission as yet, as I guess we can be thankful for that much at least. From Normandy, his ship went to southern France for more landings, then Italy. With the Navy shooting at Italian bombers, American paratroopers may have been casualties of friendly fire. The ship returned to England, escorting barges. Eventually, he traveled to Cold Bay, Alaska, as the war came to an end on his return home. Langenheim then reported to Okinawa, Japan. He also served in the Navy Reserves, where he reached the rank of lieutenant commander. Langenheim went on to graduate school and was a professor at several universities before his long tenure at the Urbana campus. He and his wife, Casey Diana, enjoy their garden and grandchildren. Second teen boy sought, warrant issued in Facebook sex assault case from Chicago. An arrest warrant has been issued for a second teenage boy in the sexual assault of a 15-year-old Chicago girl that was streamed live on Facebook, and further arrests are expected. A day after announcing the arrest of a 14-year-old boy on sexual assault and child pornography charges, police said that they were looking for a 15-year-old suspect in the March 19th attack, which investigators have said involved 5 or 6 males. Investigators didn't specify how many others would likely be charged, but they did say one adult male was among them. Police were careful not to release too many details of the ongoing investigation, but they did provide some that helped illustrate why Superintendent Eddie Johnson remained visibly upset as he has been since the investigation began. Commander Brendan Denehan said that the victim saw one of the suspects whom she knew on the day of the attack. She said the suspect lured her into the home of one of the offenders in the North Lawndale neighborhood on the city's west side, where she also lives. She was not allowed to leave, and she did not consent to what occurred. Police spokesman Anthony Giulimi said the girl was threatened by suspects, but he would not say what those threats entailed. Denehan also said there were multiple cell phone videos made of the attack, not just the one streamed live on Facebook that was viewed by about 40 people, none of whom reported it. "It disgusts me that we have people who would look at those videos and not pick up a phone and dial 911. Denehan declined to say if either of the teens who are already facing charges streamed the live video. But the charges against the 14-year-old, aggravated criminal sexual assault, manufacturing of child pornography and dissemination of child pornography, suggests that he shot video or took photographs of the attack. Last month, the girl's mother told the Associated Press that her daughter received online threats following the attack and that neighborhood kids were ringing her doorbell looking for the girl, who hasn't returned to the neighborhood. On Sunday, Denehan said police were investigating what he called social media bullying, and that detectives have executed social media search warrants in the case. He said the girl is traumatized and reluctant to talk about the attack, and that she's going to need help for a long time. After the news conference, Giuliani said city officials and the Cook County State's Attorney's Office have relocated the girl to a safe place, but he declined to elaborate. From the local page, home of former Urbana mayor still bears telltale signs of a long history. From Urbana. Abraham Lincoln slept in this house, though he didn't leave any souvenirs behind. The home at 404 West Illinois Street, built around 1850, once belonged to Urbana Mayor Ezekiel Boyden. It had been moved from its original Elm Street address and renovated several times, so it's not obvious how old it is. Brian Adams, a local history expert who is an archivist at the University of Illinois, said this could have been the only private home Lincoln ever slept in. As a lawyer for the state's 8th Judicial Circuit, the future president often visited Urbana, sometimes staying at a tavern that was formerly located at the current site of the Urbana Landmark Hotel near the courthouse. To Adams' experienced eye, the Illinois Street house offers clues to its age. Adams said the floors, some of the trim and scalloped molding, likely are original to the house. Built around 1850, it is among the oldest homes in Urbana. There are currently no known buildings still standing in Urbana that predate the 1850s. In the 1870s, there was a big fire in Urbana that burned down a lot of the older wood frame buildings in the downtown area, the same day as the Chicago fire. Donica Miller of the Urbana Free Library said the early town limits were Water Street to the north, Green Street to the south, Ray Street to the west, and Vine Street to the east. Nothing remains of the original settlement of Urbana. The earliest structures in the area were log cabins, and all of that construction has been replaced by the current downtown Urbana buildings. The University of Illinois was not created until 1867. At the Illinois Street home, the refinished oak floors on the first floor are a giveaway because they're cut much longer than later flooring. The second floor would have had cheaper pine floors, now replaced by laminate. Realtor Dina Gause of Team Gause Coldwell Bank led us into the chilly house on a chilly day and pointed out changes from the last time she showed the home. A hallway is gone since then, and the living room has been opened up. The house has seen rough times as student apartments, but previous owners fixed it up and the house is now for sale, so you could share a home with Lincoln's ghost. There are granite counters in the kitchen Lincoln wouldn't have seen, and he wouldn't have used the air conditioning. But he did probably sleep in a back bedroom. There are three bedrooms upstairs, a large one presumably for the Boyden family, one that's just tiny, and one that was just right for the great rail splitter. Mayor Boyden's home is an Urbana local historic landmark with a plaque next to the front door. According to a story in the Chicago Daily Press and Tribune, Lincoln stayed overnight as a guest at Boynton's house on September 24, 1858, not long before his run for the presidency. Boynton owned a successful plow and wagon factory on Main Street. The house was at 303 West Elm Street when Lincoln stayed, according to city records. It's quite unlikely there's a house in Champaign where Lincoln stayed because the town, then called West Urbana, was tiny at the time. It had just sprung up with a few citizens near the new route of the Illinois Central Tracks, and it was far from the old courthouse on the same ground where the Champaign County Courthouse now stands. Buildings aside, you can see two large millstones in front of the building at the Anita Purvis Nature Center. These date to 1836 and were moved from a mill built by John Brownfield. The mill was located on the Saline Branch. The Urbana Historic Preservation Commission website has an interactive map of the 100 most important buildings in Urbana, and you can click on an address and get a summary of what's known of the building. School Project is Building Momentum, public fundraising campaign launching this weekend from Champaign. An address change is in the works for Judah Christian School, but for Judah officials, the move is about so much more than a change in location. Come fall 2019, the private Christian school will pack up and move to its new $26 million home, transitioning from its 4-acre lot on North Prospect Avenue to 50 sprawling acres on the northern intersection of Rising Road and Kirby Avenue. The two-story facility will feature all the essentials of a 21st century school with capacity to serve 750 students K through 12, up from the 525 enrolled at the school currently. Officials hired Ratio Architecture to design the facility. Architects Jessica Gilbert and Ed Scopel have spent the past year working with study groups of Judah faculty, staff, parents, board members, and students to design a product Judah students could be proud of. Last October, the school began raising money through contributions from members of the Judah community. After raising about $11.5 million of the $26 million needed to complete the school, officials are ready to go public with their Judah Raising fundraising campaign, with the hopes of beginning construction on the new school in spring of 2018. The school will be separated into grade level wings, similar to how the current building is, designed to give each age group its own space while allowing the whole school to work collaboratively in one building. That was important to students and parents. The layout will be all connected, but we will have a distinct identity for each school division. Our older students interacting with our younger students is something we really encourage. A 7,000-square-foot section of the first floor of the building will feature a large commons area, which will include a chapel, space for parents to congregate, and a work area for secondary students who want to use their laptops or work on school projects together. We'll be challenging some of our secondary students to stretch themselves a little more, to think and act in ways that are more like college students. We think this type of collaborative learning space will definitely help accomplish that. Other features of the new school will include an outdoor classroom and potentially a greenhouse. Both learning spaces will be developed in collaboration with local businesses and farmers. We really want to use these 50 acres we have out here to do something that represents the agricultural context that we live in. Two gyms. A primary gym will seat 1,000 people and be used for varsity games, and a secondary gym will be for 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th grade competitive indoor sports. Modern must-haves like STEM labs and state-of-the-art science classrooms, a multimedia library, art, music, and band rooms, weight rooms, an outdoor student plaza, and a new playground area. The already complete Field of Dreams, a $3 million outdoor athletic facility with an artificial turf soccer field, a baseball field, a softball field, an additional soccer field for junior high athletes, and a track, plus large space for field activities. The space has already been rented by several area teams for practice, like Central High School and Unity High School for football, Eastern Illinois University for soccer, and Parkland College for baseball. and room to grow. Architects have designed the facility so that it can easily expand to hold 1,100 students if the need arises in the future. Plus, a $3 million plus auditorium could be thrown into the mix if funding becomes available. The 500-seat space could help Judah's current fine arts programs, but also be rented out by other organizations or used to host speakers and conferences. Similar to how the Field of Dreams was funded through the Charitable Trust Fund of Gene A. Salmon, the new Judah Christian School has been supported through private donations thus far. This week, officials went public with their fundraising efforts, hoping to attract donors from across the community who are not directly tied to Judah, but share the vision we have for the school, saying the capital campaign site FundJudahRising.com will be launched this weekend. This is a crossroads time in our school's history. Not only is it exciting about the facility upgrade, we know a great school is more than just facilities, but it's about people and relationships. It's our time to really think about new opportunities. This is not just to move across town. This can be an enhanced version of what we do really well already. Now we have this opportunity for new classes, new spaces, new programs, new departments that we haven't been able to do before. This is more than an address change for us. We don't want to redo Judah. We want to enhance it. And a letter to the editor. Congress putting profit over privacy. Last fall, the Federal Communications Commission enacted rules meant to help protect users of broadband and telecommunication services. These rules require that service providers inform customers of what personal information they collect, how they use it, and to whom that information could be given or sold under what circumstances. The FCC rules reflect the fact that every person has a right to know how their personal information will be used and to make an informed decision about using a service based upon that knowledge. On March 28th, however, Congress passed a joint resolution that, if signed by the President, will eliminate these rules. I'm frustrated that my public servant in the House of Representatives, Rodney Davis, assented to this decision. One must question the impact of financial support he received from Verizon, Comcast, and AT&T in the last election cycle. On whose behalf does he govern? His constituents or his corporate donors? Who does he work to empower? His fellow citizens or immensely profitable companies? His vote is telling. Kaylin Sanders, Champaign. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Champaign News Gazette for Monday, April 3rd. Please stay tuned.